How does error find its way into the church? I've written an article in the latest edition of the online Issues Etc. journal titled From Exception to Rule, How Error Replaces Truth in the Church, and we'll send it to you for free. Just send your name and email address to journal@issuesetc.org. In the Wittenberg Trail feature, Jordan Cooper details his journey from Calvinism to Lutheranism. The latest Issues Etc. journal, journal@issuesetc.org. Well, the story itself has gotten a lot of coverage. Same-sex marriage in New York State, you've heard about that. But what about one of the most important aspects of that story, religious exemptions? You haven't read so much about that, have you? I wonder why that is. Joining us to talk about media coverage of that story and several others for the remainder of this Thursday's Issues Etc., Molly Ziegler-Hemingway. She's a reporter in Washington, D.C., a regular guest, and contributor to GetReligion.org. Molly, welcome back to Issues Etc.
Hello, Todd. Nice to be here.
Why do you think the coverage of religious exemptions in the New York same-sex marriage story has been so sparse?
Yeah, it's interesting. The media are very excited about this story, and they have been very excited about same-sex marriage and other gay rights issues for many years. And this is one of those issues that they have tended to cover with more cheerleading than thoughtful analysis. This story has been covered extensively, but one of the really interesting angles about it was that the legislation that was passed included a little bit of a religious protection clause in there, and that was one of the ways that it was able to be passed. And there has been some coverage, but there just hasn't been much of it. They just sort of describe what happened in the legislation. They might mention that it was influential in getting it passed, but they don't really drill down and look at what it means for the average religious adherent or institution.
What are the real concerns that ought to be addressed in the coverage here when it comes to same-sex marriage legalization, whether it comes through the courts or the legislature? What are the concerns that ought to be covered that religious institutions are voicing in each and every case?
Well, there's so much that could be looked at here, and I always think of the quote from the Georgetown law professor who's now with the EEOC, Chai Feldblum, who said that when it comes to a conflict between gay rights and religious freedom, she has a hard time seeing where religious freedom would win out. She wasn't, although she is a gay rights activist, she wasn't making a point about how it should be so much as how the law works. And basically, if you make if you advance certain gay rights claims, it does have an impact on how religious freedom is enjoyed by various people. So you have all sorts of things where people have come into conflict. You know, if you are a Christian who runs a business and you don't want to actually be part of a wedding planning for a same-sex couple, you can be brought up by a human rights tribunal in your state. Or if the state has written same-sex marriage into its law, or if it has a certain protection for homosexual individuals, you can be brought up on discrimination charges. And that is something that was not touched on by the New York law. If you are a wedding vendor or something like that, you would, of course, have to supply goods to a same-sex couple if you are supplying them to a heterosexual couple. But the law did include some protections for religious institutions, and so a church that declined to accommodate same-sex weddings would not be penalized later with the loss of state aid for the social service programs it administers. But there are so many different angles to this, and there's just not been much discussion of how it's going to actually work in reality. You know, if a parochial school has an honor code related to same-sex dating, will they be protected? If you're a Muslim doctor and you don't want to give in vitro fertilization to a lesbian couple a lesbian couple that's same-sex married, will you be protected? If you are a therapist and you don't want to treat a patient because you have religious qualms over same-sex marriage and you refer that patient to someone else, will you be in trouble? Will you lose your job or license? If you're a civil servant and you have a religious objection to performing a same-sex marriage ceremony, will you lose your job? You know, there are so many different questions, and the media are just surprisingly uncurious about how the change in this law might affect religious people at a lower level.
For their part, the New York Times described the religious protections in the law as expansive. Is that an accurate term?
Well, I don't know. I actually think that it is a significant, that what happened in the law there was very significant. And I do think it's important because you've seen that some of the biggest conflicts between same-sex marriage and religious institutions happen when, you know, let's say you're the Catholic Church and you have qualms over doing something related to same-sex marriage. You could lose your funding, or you don't give the people that you employ at your religious institution, you don't give them the right to be covered under insurance if they're same-sex married, and all of a sudden you're not in compliance with state law, and then you lose your funding. I'm not sure. I'm not even exactly sure, actually, how well this law would cover them, but it's at least a start. And so I think it's interesting and significant. Expansive? I wouldn't say expansive by any stretch of the imagination, but really that word is not one you would want to use in a journalism story. Anyway, you just want it to describe what is being protected and what's not, and maybe let other people characterize it as expansive or limited.
You use the term jubilant for much of the media coverage of the New York law change. Why do you use that word?
Because there's just no question that that's what the coverage has always been. I mean, you see it every time any state does anything like this. I believe it was the New York Times ombudsman who described his own paper's coverage of gay rights as cheerleading, and that's always seemed to be an accurate phrase. There's never any downside presented to any of these changes in law. There's no discussion of any qualms that people might have, or if they are, they're kind of portrayed as from a fringe group of meanies who just are against love. It's not been a high point in media coverage. People always talk about how the media were so exuberant in the march to war in Iraq. There are differing sides on that, but it sort of reminds me of that. There's just not a lot of critical, thoughtful coverage of what these changes might mean for social norms, for religious institutions, for religious adherents themselves. You know, how it's going to affect public school curriculum. You know, you just don't see any of those basic stories, but instead you just see pictures of really fresh-faced, lovely people who are, you know, now going to be gay married. And that's certainly, there's room for that kind of coverage, and it's certainly an exciting time for a lot of people. There's not even a pretense of balance in most of this coverage.
Something else I wanted to talk to you about. The Associated Press ran a story that was, well, it had a problem with a few rather significant details. What was the story about, and what details did the reporter miss?
Sure. There's an Associated Press reporter who covers the Mormon Church, which is kind of interesting because she frequently makes mistakes about the Mormon Church when she covers them, or she just seems to have almost a personal issue in covering that church. But she had a story that was, you know, pretty good about how the Mormon Church has issued a restatement and clarification of its position on whether some of its highest officers should be involved in politics. And they generally say you should not be involved in politics. And so it was just a story explaining how that works. But midway through the story, she said something like, refers to the ballot initiative Proposition 8, which passed in 2006. Now, Prop 8, the initiative that banned same-sex marriage in California, actually passed in 2008. And so that's your first indication that maybe attention to detail is not her strong suit. But in the concluding paragraph, she quotes someone that she says is a political expert on the topic, Francis Beckwith. And she describes him as a Mormon. Now, Francis Beckwith is incredibly well-known in both evangelical and Catholic circles. You know, he's a professor at Baylor. He's written, I don't know how many books, but some of them have been about his criticisms of the Mormon Church and their doctrine. He wrote a pretty well-known book about how he returned to Catholic Church in 2007. This was national news because he was head of the Evangelical Theological Society at the time that he did this. So it was just, it was like, it was a huge coup for the Catholics that he went back to Catholicism. And yet this religion reporter for the Associated Press apparently does not know enough about Frank Beckwith to know that he's not Mormon. Now, it's not even if he didn't know it, which is not really a statement in her favor, to not be able to Google that, I mean, it's just, it's just silly. She wouldn't have that, you know, basic bit of knowledge, you know, from the first Google search. But anyway.
But she quotes Beckwith in the story. One would think that, and I'm not a journalist, but one would think that if you're on the phone with Frank Beckwith and you're asking him questions, looking for a quote, the first thing you're going to do in your conversation with him is just check your facts with regard to the person you're talking to.
Right. Like, I'm not sure how she found him. You know, there was a reason why he was being called, presumably. And maybe, you know what, maybe it's an editing error or something, so maybe it's not even the reporter's issue here. But, yeah, obviously he's a good source because he talks about politics and church state studies all the time. He's written many books about it. And like I said, he's also written about Mormonism. So he's, you know, for being a Catholic, former evangelical, he's pretty familiar with Mormonism. So he's not a bad perspective to get in the story at all. He's a great perspective to get in the story. But in order for her to know that, she had to have known something about him, right? So I don't know, again, where it happened, if it was the reporter or the editor or what, but to describe him as a Mormon is just a really embarrassing error.
Well, when we come back, we'll talk a little bit more with Molly Ziegler-Hemingway of GetReligion.org, a reporter in Washington, D.C. Some of the stories we'll talk about. There is an Eastern Orthodox church that has yet to be rebuilt near Ground Zero. See what she thinks about that and the media coverage of it. We'll also talk a little bit about a story that turned out not to be true. In fact, two stories that turned out not to be true regarding Islam and Delta Airlines, the stoning of a dog, which is just very odd, and in there, of course, all the mix about who can fly and who can't fly on Delta. They said no Jews can fly on Delta into Saudi Arabia. That story turned out to be entirely false. We'll see what Molly Ziegler-Hemingway has to say about that on the other side of the break. I'm Todd Wilkin. This is Issues Etc. It's Thursday afternoon, June the 30th. Stay tuned.
Started in 1972 by Wilbur and Larry Surrey, Oak Brook Golf Club is now the most affordable, friendliest, and consistently well-conditioned course in the Bi-State area. You will never break the bank to play Oak Brook, and we guarantee you will get your money's worth. With three nines, we have more tee times, making it easy to finish your round on time. We have the most experienced ground crew in the area, allowing us to always remain in great shape. At Oak Brook, golf is our business. The staff has been consistently voted the most friendly in the area. We offer an award-winning senior scramble on Tuesdays, PGA professionals on staff, family specials year-round where kids play free, lessons, junior camps, men's and women's leagues, and countless outings to satisfy your golfing needs. With our ever-improving course conditions and reasonable pricing, the choice is easy. Oak Brook Golf Club is the course to play. Contact us at 618-656-5600 or at oakbrookgc.com.
Luther had Wartburg. We have Collinsville. You're listening to Issues Etc.
Steadfast Lutherans. People who believe the law condemns everyone and should be preached to the fullest. People who believe the gospel is for everyone and should be preached to its sweetest. Traditional Lutheran doctrine and practice deliver every Sunday this law and gospel, that Christ was crucified for us sinners. To all who received him, who believed in his name, the Gospel of John says, he gave the right to become children of God. To see how Steadfast Lutherans preserves this good news for everyone, visit steadfastlutherans.org.
How does error find its way into the church? I've written an article in the latest edition of the online Issues Etc. journal titled From Exception to Rule, How Error Replaces Truth in the Church, and we'll send it to you for free. Just send your name and email address to journal@issuesetc.org. In the Wittenberg Trail feature, Jordan Cooper details his journey from Calvinism to Lutheranism. The latest Issues Etc. journal, journal@issuesetc.org. Welcome back to Issues Etc. 10 more minutes on this Thursday afternoon with Molly Ziegler-Hemingway. We're going through some stories in the media, getting her evaluation of how the religious angle has or hasn't been covered. Molly, there were a couple other stories you've written about recently that raised your journalistic red flags as to their very veracity. What are they?
Well, I don't know. I mean, there have been some interesting stories, I think, about there was a big story last weekend that took off on Friday about Delta Airlines and how it was banning Jews from flights to Saudi Arabia. And it's a really interesting story. I guess I should cut to the chase immediately and say it's not true. But it's an interesting story because Saudi Arabia, of course, is one of the world's most repressive regimes when it comes to religious freedom. And we never talk about this because they are, of course, a huge ally to the Americans, and there's lots of money and political engagement there. And they are brutally repressive. Not allowed to be a Christian in that country to practice your faith in any way. If you bring a Bible into the country, it's frequently taken from you. They literally do not let any Israeli into the country, but they say that they're not anti-Semitic because they'll let Jews from other countries come into the country. So it's a really repressive regime. Obviously, right now they've got their story about how women are fighting for the right to drive vehicles there. And we just don't see a lot of coverage of what it's like to be a non-Muslim and even just an outlier Muslim practicing their religion in that country. So I was glad to see the coverage of these problems, but the story was just riddled with problems from the outset. I mean, Delta's not actually flying to Saudi Arabia. They do have a partnership with Saudi Arabian Airlines, which is owned by, at least in part, by the government. But the story basically ran as Delta Airlines is banning Jews and Bibles on flights to Saudi Arabia. They are an alliance, but they don't even share, I think it's like you get to share booking privileges, but you're not actually even sharing frequent flyer miles there's something arcane about the ticketing and whatnot. And of course, Jews are permitted to go to Saudi Arabia. They're just not permitted if they're Israeli citizens. And so it just had a lot of problems. And then, of course, it was such an exciting news story that it spread like wildfire. And it took, a good almost week, I'd say, for the story to finally get retracted. But, of course, by then, the reputation that Delta had suffered was probably pretty significant, the harm to their reputation that they'd suffered. And the other thing that kind of bothers me about it is because it ended up being retracted, I think that people still don't have a good idea about the problem with religious freedom in Saudi Arabia, and that's still undercovered. I'm worried that people are going to be scared about covering that story because of how poorly this particular example was handled. But that's probably the best example of a major error we've seen lately.
What about the story of a Jewish court condemning a dog to death by stoning?
Here's the thing I don't get about this. There's a story about a Jewish court in Israel condemning a dog to death by stoning. And I feel that all reporters should have a really good built-in detector for what's probably not true. The moment I read that story in Time magazine, I was like, this is probably not true. Not only because I'd just been to Israel a few months ago and it just seemed somewhat hard to believe that even the most extreme of the ultra-Orthodox would be doing this, but there were no quotes in the story that were matched with any actual names. There were no dates. There were nothing that you could kind of independently verify. And that is also a story that spread like wildfire throughout the blogosphere, and everyone was like, those horrible Jews are killing dogs by stoning, and look how backward they are. And, of course, part of that might be that some people, they want to think, certain things about groups of people that they might not be politically or otherwise aligned with and whatnot. So it just spread like crazy. And, of course, it was not true at all. And it actually, one of the interesting things about it is there was like a report somewhere, and it had been pulled or corrected by the time people started picking it up and running with it. And I think that's interesting, too, is that even after it had been corrected, people still wanted to believe it was true, and so they still spread that one. But, yeah, that was not a high mark for Time magazine or the other outlets that ran with a completely false story there.
The final thing I wanted you to talk about was St. Nicholas Greek Orthodox Church near Ground Zero, destroyed September 11th, 2001. What's the status on that building?
Yeah, just interestingly enough, I happen to be visiting a friend's Greek Orthodox church in Brooklyn, and that congregation has opened up its facilities to the people of St. Nicholas then and their congregation was, or their church was completely destroyed on September 11th. It's the only house of worship that was destroyed by the terrorist attacks on that date, and it's still not been rebuilt. And it's a very confusing and weird story about bureaucratic bungling, and it's just a very, very sad story about what's happened to this congregation. But it's received almost no coverage. And what I think is particularly interesting about this is that, of course, it wasn't quite a year ago, or I guess it was about a year ago, when the media started exploding with stories about the attempts to build that mosque and Islamic center being constructed near Ground Zero. People were all upset and up in arms about it. And what I think is interesting about it is not just at the disparity in the media coverage of those two houses of worship, but also the failure to follow through on that with other angles. So the City of New York obviously was working overtime to try and help the Cordova Center, Park 51, and whatnot with getting through permit processes and whatnot to construct their house of worship there, whereas it's been a much more adversarial relationship with the Greeks at St. Nicholas. There are also interesting things such as the fact that the congregation that used to reside in the lower Manhattan area there in the financial district has kind of been displaced through demographic changes. So it's also interesting to just see how small that St. Nicholas congregation is now, because, frankly, very few people live down in that part of Manhattan. There's so many different angles you could take with this, but instead, pretty much nobody's been covering it, and it's just not as interesting to the media. And I think that's unfortunate, because this is, that this congregation was destroyed on 9/11. There's, symbolic and real significance to this, and it's just not been, unfortunately, not many people have been very interested in it. Now, the Religion News Service did write a story about a protest that the Greeks took part in last weekend this week, and I think that's good that they were covering it. Just a shame that more people aren't interested in covering that story.
You've also recently written about the coverage of a Yonathan Malaku, an immigrant from Ethiopia, near where you live at the Pentagon. What was the story, and what's your concern about the coverage?
Well, I thought the story was interesting, in part because I live right near the Pentagon, so I've been kind of following it when the story broke. But this man was arrested, and then within a week or so, he was charged in conjunction with all these attacks that have been taking place at military installations around the area. And we did know that there were certain things that, I guess you could say, tied him to Islamic terrorism. We learned that he had a notebook that had comments in favor of Al-Qaeda and Taliban in his car, and that when he had shot up these other military installations, he'd videotaped himself saying, like, Allahu Akbar, and that obviously, you would obviously think that has something to do with Islamic terrorism. But what intrigued me, in part because we have Ethiopian Christians in my church, was that the name immediately stuck out to me as a Christian name. His name is Yonathan Malaku. And that is not, most Ethiopians are Christian, of course. I think it's like two-thirds or three-quarters. And I did run it by some Ethiopian friends, and they said that it did sound like a Christian or Jewish name. So I was wondering why we just didn't see more coverage of what his actual religion was, and did he convert? What's going on here? And there just has been remarkably little coverage of it. And the one exception is I noticed right away that Fox News was describing him as Muslim. And I understand he probably is Muslim, but they didn't explain how or anything about it. He lives here in the area. He lives in Alexandria, the same city I live in. And I just don't understand why reporters aren't digging into the local communities there to find out more about his religion and if it's changed or anything. There's just, again, not much interest, I guess, in this part of the story. So perhaps that will change, and maybe it's just taking reporters a little bit more time to get to the bottom of that interesting name and how it relates to his views on Al-Qaeda and whatnot.
Molly Ziegler-Hemingway is a reporter in Washington, D.C., and a contributor to GetReligion.org. Molly, it's always a pleasure. Thanks for your time.
Thank you.
Folks, 3 years ago today, the studio I'm sitting in right now went live for the very first time after a three-month hiatus after being canceled by the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod. Issues Etc. returned to radio, to the internet, on demand, podcasters. Our listeners have kept us on the air for 3 years running now. And while I expected our listeners to be faithful in their listening and in their support, they have exceeded my expectations. What can I say after 3 years back on the air on this day, June the 30th, to our listeners except thank you. Thank you for keeping us on the air. Thank you for bringing us back on the air. Thank you for listening. And thanks, as usual, for all your faithful support. It really means a lot to us. We're here for you. We will be tomorrow as well when we play Issues Etc. Soundbite of the Week. I'm Todd Wilkin. Talk with you again tomorrow. Thanks for listening to Issues Etc.
Listen weekday afternoons to Pastor Todd Wilkin and guests on Issues Etc. Issues Etc. is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is vital for the continuation and expansion of this worldwide outreach. Our mailing address, Lutheran Public Radio, P.O. Box 912, Collinsville, Illinois, 62234. Box 912, Collinsville, Illinois, 62234. You can also donate at our website, issuesetc.org. Issues Etc. is a production of LPR, Lutheran Public Radio.